Thanks, Brian.
I'm Jerry Minocalk.
I'm Jerry.
I think it was probably August of 2002 when I met Don. I was in another fellowship and went to the meeting, and I was all excited about going. Came home, called my sponsor, and I said, Melvin, this is guy. He's a maniac, and he looked just like Stevie Wonder. And he acted like, and he goes, did he do this? Did he do this? He goes, that's Don Bryant. I said, really? And apparently, you know, everybody knows Don Bryant, and he's very, very popular. And I've had an opportunity to hear Don speak on several occasions. I used to see him at the Atlanta Roundup, or at the Rock, when I would go to the Rock. And he was always working with somebody, always had somebody in tow. He's involved in the heavy hitters. He's involved in the 10th Street group. And I texted him, said, what do you think about speaking on this date? He goes, sure, I'm in. And it's great to have you here. Thank you for committing that. I give you Don.
Hey, family, my name is Don Bryant, and I am a real alcoholic.
Hey, John.
And it's by God's grace and the company I keep, I haven't found it necessary to pick up a drink or a drug today. And for that, I'm truly grateful. And I want to thank everybody here for being here, because I can't do this by myself. My sobriety date is April 5th, 1995. My home group is the Heavy Hitters Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and also the 10th Street Group. So it's really an honor to be here at Primary Purpose. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to share a little bit about what it was like, a little bit, because we all know what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I'm going to do something that I never do. And one of the things that is nobody ever sees me without my glasses on. Have you ever heard the expression, Brian, that the eyes are the windows to one's soul? Have you heard that expression? My windows are tinted, that's all. I got tinted windows, so you'll have to bear with me. See, I'm going through conniptions. Just putting them on. Oh. That way I can still see. You know, when I first came into AA, you know, I was really beat up. Well, these are kind of smeared. I was weighing about 115 pounds. I had all these scars from all my surgeries. Have you ever heard of Josh about the person, the guy who spoke out the side of his neck?
No.
Have you ever heard that expression?
No.
Anybody ever hear that? He talked out the side of his neck? Now you met him. I'm that guy. And I had dreadlocks and a carry top, my glasses, my dark glasses. I had the shakes. And I was so decimated that I couldn't get into a treatment. I remember going to my first meeting, and the plan was to get me into treatment after going to this first meeting. So we went to this treatment facility, and they said, no, sorry, can't help you. You're too much of a health liability. Went to the second place. Sorry, can't help you. Too much of a health liability. Third place, same story. I said, wait a minute, I got money. I could pay for this. Can't help you. And I finally get to this place, the fourth place, and this is how God works in my life. One of the counselors there was someone I went to high school with. And even though she didn't do the interview with me, I have to believe that she put in a good word for me, because they came to me and they said, well, here's what we'll do. If you can stay sober for a week and come back next week, we'll let you into our outpatient program. And I said, if I could stay sober for a week, my little black ass wouldn't be here now. How do I do that? And they said, we don't care how you do it. Just do it. And that's how it's been for me from day one. So I was going to all these meetings, and I was going to AA meetings, I was going to NA meetings, I was going to CA meetings, and I was in a fog, so I was getting kind of confused. I was getting real confused. So I stopped one guy one time, and I said, you know, man, you know, AA uses the big book, CA uses the big book. I can say I'm an alcoholic in AA, but I can't say I'm an alcoholic in CA, and I'm all confused. I said, what's the difference? He explained it to me this way. He said, well, in AA, we do our sugar like this. And in CA, we do our sugar like this. Anyway, identify? I'm in the right spot. Okay. I was born February 11, 1952. I have a twin sister. So I was born on a team. I also have triplet sisters that are 2 years behind us. So by the time I was 2 years old, we were featured in the New York Daily News. Picture my mother with the five of us there. She's carrying my three sisters and me and my sister on the side. So I've always had notoriety. And living in New York, grew up in Harlem, I'm actually fourth generation college educated. My great-grandfather was a slave, and he then became president of West Virginia State University. We had named our family names on the building and stuff like that. And so education and the thinking process was always paramount in my household, as well as achievement, had to achieve. Part of what was called in those days, you might not know this, so you might have to go Google it, the talented 10th. I'm part of the talented 10th. And that was a philosophy endowed by W.E.B. Du Bois, who was the first president of NAACP, who said that the philosophy was there was 10% of the African-American population was going to raise the other 90% through education and achievement. See, there was a corresponding philosophy, which was by Booker T. Washington, and that philosophy was you had to pull yourself up by the bootstraps by engaging in trades, whether it be masonry, carpentry. So those are the two competing things. So I was part of the talented 10th. So, growing up, I always felt different because I was always a peewee. I was always real tiny. And my mother and father were separated. So I grew up with my four sisters, my grandmother, and my mother. So I didn't play with my sisters. I didn't want to have anything to do with them. So I got my education out in the streets with the guys. So by the time I was 12, I had several friends that were dead from heroin overdoses or being committed to mental asylums. And I was running around with the wrong crowd, and I was never got in trouble, but I was doing mischievous things, like breaking a bottle, pulling in on somebody, trying to cut them, stealing nickel and dime candy, you know, you had to prove your worth. So my mother moved us to New Jersey when I was in sixth grade. And one of the problems with that was in New York, I was in a school for advanced students. Students who were advanced for their age, me and my sister. And when we moved to New Jersey, excuse me, those same facilities weren't there. So there was never any drinking in my house. None. Maybe occasionally at Thanksgiving, Maybe have some Manischewitz wine. Maybe. So, I didn't have any home experience with drinking. And then in junior high school and high school, I was always able to achieve without having to work hard. I don't know. And I would take, when I was in high school, my sophomore year, I was selected to take these summer school courses at Princeton University. So I'd take courses in film history, English lit, and contemporary literature. Because I was always reading and reading and reading. But about that time, let me back up. See, I'm a showbiz baby. I'm second generation theater professional. My mother was in an organization called the American Negro Theater back in the 50s. And how that organization came, Ozzie Davis, Ruby Dee, Sidney Poitier, Harry Belafonte, Hilda Simms, Frederick O'Neill, Helen Martin. So I grew up backstage, always in showbiz, backstage. My mother was on Broadway. And so one of the things that I did was, there was no such thing as race in the theater. People. So I wasn't cognizant of any racial differences growing up. And in high school, I was an athlete. I used to play a lot of baseball and basketball. And at that time, if you were a drinker, that was frowned upon because everybody was getting high. Everybody was smoking marijuana, you know, grasshoppers, we used to call them, grasshoppers. And so I just experimented a little bit, not too much. But the day before I was supposed to go to college, we had been playing basketball. And me and my friend Newton, we had played ball, and we were going to go over Kevin Harris's house and play some pinochle. So I'm a pinochle fanatic. So we decided before we go to Kevin's house, we need to go by this place called Ducky Donuts so we could get some french fries because we knew we were going to drink a little bit. So we get over to Kevin's house, and Kevin has big half gallon of Thunderbird wine. What's the word? Thunderbird. What's the price? 50 twice. So we drank that, and I don't know if I got that warm feeling like some people get. I just knew I didn't like the taste, but I liked the way I was feeling. So we decided to get another half gallon. Got that, and then shortly after that, I changed my name to Ralph Earl. Am I familiar with Ralph? Mm-hmm. Ralph Earl. Next day, go off to college. And I went to a small private institution called Hampton Institute in Hampton, Virginia. And it was right on the Chesapeake Bay. We had a waterfront and the beach, excuse me, was 5 minutes away. It was like being at a resort. The female population was 8-1, women to men, and I was in heaven. Now, see, I didn't know this was going to be a pattern in my life. I had gotten into school as a pre-law student. You know, I was Boys State and all that stuff. And I had all these scholarships. And I was standing in line in the pre-law registration. And to my right, I saw Dolly Calhoun, the finest specimen of womanhood I had ever seen in my life. And right there on the spot, I changed my major So I begin to knelt down. See, now, that's what I do. Because I'm a real, I don't care type of alcoholic. I don't care about consequences. I don't care. So, speech and drama major at Hampton, and things go well, but I became a connoisseur of fine wine. Boone's Farm. Thunderbird. Spinata. Saying supper time. Richard's Wild Irish Rose. Mad Dog. Night Train. And I used to go at 4 o'clock and I'd stand on the corner right in front of the cafeteria and I'd ask for contributions for a community wine for the community brothers and sisters. It's all you gotta pay. Nickel down 25 cents. What do you want to contribute? We'll meet you right here on the steps at 6 o'clock. Anything you give could be greatly appreciated. And what made that work was we would get the wine and we would show up. And so people would be a little more generous in giving. So we'd have wine, and I used to play pinochle. So when I wasn't begging for money, we'd go up in one of the girls' dorms and play pinochle for a penny a point, and then sucker somebody in, and then raise it to a nickel a point so we could have enough money to run down to the ABC store so we could get a bottle of cherry piafra and sneak it into the cafeteria so we could have wine at dinner. You know, that's how we did. I just went buck wild in college. I know we have a singleness of purpose here, but it's part of my story. I did so many drugs. LSD, mescaline, peyote, psilocybin, quaaludes, black beauties, red devils, cocaine, opium, you name it. I did it. What was your drug of choice? Oh, whatever it is. Get high by any means necessary. And I had no consequences. So I graduated from school, and I moved back to New Jersey, and I'm up there working as a fundraising consultant. And I call my old college roommate, see what's happening, and he says, look, I need some help. I need your help. Can you come and help me? I said, can you put me up? He said, sure. So I quit my job, flew down to Atlanta, and we started working at this theater. It was a little theater. It was tied in with SCLC. Anybody familiar with SCLC? Hosea Williams or his daughter Liz Omalani, that she does the Hosea Feed the Hungry. Well, Liz and I went to school together, so I knew Byron and I knew Liz. So I said, I'll be all right in Atlanta. And we started doing theater and stuff like that, and getting high all the time. As soon as I wake up, getting high. Go to work, step outside, getting high. And then Jose wanted us to, I had gotten this CETA position. Y'all would know what CETA is, the Comprehensive Educational Training Act that was done by Jimmy Carter. And it gave artists an opportunity to have a legitimate check doing their art. So I was an artist in residence at this theater. And what happened was Jose wanted us to go do a demonstration, to demonstrate against somebody. Well, you see, I did not grow up with that. I was not a big advocate of Dr. Martin Luther King. I was an advocate of Malcolm X, Stokely Carmichael, A-Trap Brown, and the Panthers. So politically, I was way over here, and Jose was way over there. So I said, no, man, I'm not going to march with no damn picket sign. So what he did was he locked us. He took a chain and locked the doors of the theater so we couldn't get in. Locked us out. So I had to get a job. So because I was getting a check for about a month without having to go to work, and they said, you finally have to go with this. Got to do it. You can either go to the Lions Theater or you can go to Theater of the Stars and Just Us Theater. So I went to Theater of Stars and Just Us Theater because I hated the Alliance. Because the Alliance was the plantation. You understand? Because at that time, the only roles that black actors got were butlers and maids. That was it. And I came from a different diaspora than that. So I couldn't do that. So we started this little theater. Well, we didn't start it. Sam Jackson actually started it. Samuel L. Jackson and his wife LaTanya actually started the theater along with Eddie Billups. And so we started doing that. And at that time I was just acting. And there was a crossroads where we had to decide if you're going to build an institution or pursue a performing career. Well, what had happened? I had gotten a little taste of the golden rule in theater. Does anybody know what the golden rule of theater is? He who has the gold rules. So I took a journeymanship learning how to be a producer. Raising money, raising vast sums of money by writing proposals to the various, sundry funding sources, Atlanta Bureau of Cultural Affairs, Fulton County Arts Council, Georgia Council for the Arts, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Byron and I had a good writing schematic where we could write and get grants. And so we were doing that, but it wasn't enough. So every day at 4 o'clock, our theater was located at 14th and Peachtree. It's now, I forget the name of the club that it is, it's now a little nightclub, right on 14th and Peachtree or 14th and Crescent. It was Petrus at one time, and it became something else, but it used to be the Peachtree Playhouse, which was a 700-seat theater. Which meant, well, that I could compete economically with the Alliance Theater with their 720 seats. See, I have 714, they have 720. So when you go into funding sources, you can say we're making an economic impact, because if you understand that every dollar spent in the theater turns over 7 times in the community. So not only did we have an economic impact, when I'm talking to politicians, I can say, these are your constituency. Say, this is your constituency right here. These are the people that vote for you. You need to be at my show. You learn how to win through a little bit of intimidation. See, because they can't say no. Not if you're a black politician in a black city like Atlanta. You can't say no. You have to show up. So it's like dangling a little carrot. And we started growing, but as we were growing, my capacity for drinking increased, as well as maintaining my marijuana desires. So all day long. Drinking. Used to be this place called Country Place. It was right on the corner of 14th and Peach. It was in this building called Colony Square, which is a hotel. And they had this restaurant called Country Place. And at happy hour, they'd serve drinks for a dollar a drink, top shelf. And you know the thing about happy hour? I would go to happy hour every day, and I never got happy. I just got drunk. And that would be the starting point for me. So one day I was doing the show, and a friend said to me, "What you doing after the show, Dom?" I said, "Nothing." He said, "Well, I got some cocaine. We're going to do some cocaine." I said, no, I don't want any cocaine because I burnt out my nasal passages. See, what we used to do in college, anybody smoke marijuana here? Anybody ever save their roaches? Well, we would save the roaches, put them in tissue paper, then take match heads and tear off the match heads and put those in the tissue paper, twist it up, make a little ball, and then light it, and then inhale it. called a smoke bomb. And I burnt out all my nasal passages. So when it came time to snort some cocaine, I said, no, it's going to be a waste of money. I'm not going to do that. He said, we're not going to snort it. We're going to smoke it. I said, oh, yeah. He said, oh, yeah. So this was about 1980. And I became a weekend warrior. Because I remember sitting down and taking that first hit and the sense of euphoria and achievement, actually, because this was what I was looking for all my life. This was my high. And so, I'm hitting and drinking, hitting and drinking. So, I became a weekend warrior. So I do Friday and Saturday, take off Sunday so I could be straight for Monday, because in the theater, the only day you have off is Monday if you're not doing it, if you're doing a show, you have Monday off. If you're not doing the show, you don't have any days off. You're working constantly, and I was working 12 to 14 hours a day. Because not only were we doing Just Us Theater, we were doing Theater of the Stars. And I was working with some of the biggest stars in the industry. Dick Van Dyke, Anne Margaret, Donald O'Connor, George Bizarre, Tammy Grimes, Leonard Nimoy. I'm in real showbiz, learning how to be a producer. So they would do 6 weeks of summer musicals and 6 weeks of winter play season, where it'd be comedies and dramas. So each stretch was 43 straight days without a day off. Plus we're doing four other shows 2 weeks there. So I was spending 30 weeks a year doing theater. And you know how it is. It's a lot of pressure when you gotta raise all the money. So I need something to, you know, Brian, you know what I mean? I gotta relax, right? So it's a weekend warrior, Friday and Saturday. So Friday and Saturday eventually became Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And Friday, Saturday, and Sunday eventually became Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday eventually became Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday eventually became Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday eventually became Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Thursday eventually became Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. For the next 14 years, I smoked cocaine every day. So cocaine and drank every single day. And I didn't have consequences like other people. I never got arrested for anything. I made it a practice to stay out of American jurisprudence. I always ended up in ICUs, Piedmont, Crawford Long, Grady, Georgia Baptist, North Fulton, South Fulton. I've had my lungs collapse. I got a metal plate and rod in my right leg. I've had all my air passages blocked. So when my lung collapsed, since I'm an eternal optimist, okay, it's all right. I got another one. I'll be all right. Let me get high. Let me go. That's how I do. I drink in the hospital, in the ICU. That's what I do, because I couldn't get the thought out of my head. I'm either thinking about drinking or I'm thinking about not drinking. It's 9:30. I got a little bit of time. I don't need to get to the club before 10, but if I don't go now, I won't be able to make. No, I better go now. No, if you go now, you're going to spend all day long thinking about it, not thinking about it. Thinking about drinking, thinking about not drinking. So this went on for years. I started getting high in 1967. So it was February 95. I was at my play sister's house, and I woke up and my neck was all swollen. My face was all swollen. I couldn't talk. So we rushed down to the Grady, and because I didn't look like I was dying, it took a little while. Prior to that, we had gotten stopped by the police because we made a left-hand turn 10 minutes before you were supposed to, on from Boulevard to Edgewood. And so the cop pulled us over, and I'm writing in a notepad, I need to get to the hospital because I can't breathe and I'm dying. Write the ticket here and we'll be all right. I don't care about the ticket. And I wasn't even driving, but he didn't see it that way, so he made me wait. And by the time they got to me, they said, we have to operate on you right here. So they took me to a little room, and they operated on me in the room. And that's the way it's always been with me. When my lung collapsed, they had to do it in the waiting room. I never get the big treatment. I always get stuck. So they had to, I had 5 trachs. And I was in intensive care for 9 days and another 28 days on the ward. And that not one time did I think about getting better. I thought about getting out, having a drink. So they released me from the hospital. Before I left Grady's grounds, I stepped out the door. My dope man drove by, he said, let's, and I said, go. And that was February 95. And then I'm at this party, this theater party, and I'm throwing down these beers. I must have done 2 6-packs in an hour. And then I got what we call a moment of clarity. I said, something's wrong. I'm not high, and I don't have to use the bathroom. So I said, so I figured something was wrong with this picture. So I called up this friend of mine. He said, well, meet me tomorrow at 2775 Glenwood. I said, okay. And all night long, I'm pacing, trying to figure out what I'm going to do. And I say to my friend, Lark, I say, Lark, if I go do this AA thing, everybody's going to know I'm an alcoholic dope fiend. She said, Don, they already do. See, I was the last one to know. So I went to this first meeting, and as I shared earlier, the plan was to get into treatment. That didn't happen. So I had to detox in these rooms. I picked up my white chip, and I used to walk around with it because I literally know thousands of people in the city of Atlanta, literally. And anywhere I go, I'm going to run into somebody, and they say, let's, I say, go. So I walked to meetings and walked to meetings, and I had about 10 days clean, and I was supposed to be getting an annuity payment from this car accident that I was in. Nice piece of change. Check didn't come. So I was staying with Laura, and I've been going through these meetings, and I've been hearing about this rigorous honesty. Are you willing to go to any length to get it? So, because I was so full of pride, I wasn't going to ask anybody to let me stay with them. I don't ask a clock for the time of day. I told her I would move out, and my keen alcoholic mind decided to move to the Atlanta airport. And I lived in the Atlanta airport for the next 60 days. And I had $10,000 floating around somewhere. Because I had to see, what was I willing to do? What was I willing to do? So as I'm going to meetings, and I'm going to meetings, and something struck me. On page 14 in the big book. Anybody have a big book? Okay, Clarissa, yeah. Go to the bottom of page 14. It says, for if an alcoholic fails to enlarge and perfect his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he will not be able to meet the certain trials and low spots ahead. I was shown that that's a guarantee. That's a guarantee in this book. I was told that this was a spiritual program, not religious. Okay? I'm sure of this. That didn't work for me. Because I went to this first meeting, and the first thing they did, they opened up with a prayer. Next thing they did, they passed around the basket. After that, they said, does anybody want to come join us? And I said, I've been bullshitting again. But I had no place else to go. See, I couldn't get the thought out of my head. So, has anybody heard this in the rooms? Don't get involved with anyone for your first year. Wait, see, that didn't apply to me. I'm different. I am. So I had met this young lady, and we hit it off. Just like that. She had 10 years. Brian, she 13-stepped me. Okay. She had 10 years. I had 90 days. There was only one other complication. She was HIV positive, and I'm not. So I had to decide. What was I going to do? What type of man am I going to be? Because my MO is to cut and run. But I said, no, I'm going to stick and stay. Now, Debbie was a consultant for the CDC and the Georgia Department of Health. She helped develop Georgia Women Preventing AIDS. And she used to lecture around the country and in the Caribbean on HIV education. So I knew it was cool. So we discussed it, had no problem. So we'd go to meetings, and I had to learn how to suppress ego, because I was used to being the center of attention. And in her world, she was. So I was Mr. Debbie. Yeah, no. So things are going well, and we go to New York for a friend of mine's wedding. And while we're up there, she starts losing a little bit of her equilibrium, and her words are kind of slurring a little bit. So we come back and have some tests done. I got about 6 months clean at this time, and going to meetings, working this little job. And the diagnosis comes back that she had this disease called BML, which only occurs in 1 to 2% of all people with HIV. It's a disease that attacks the central nervous system, creates lesions on the brain, rapidly progressive and fatal, with no known treatment and no known cure. I said, I knew from what Debbie had shown me that I couldn't cause any stress in her life at all, because that could kill her. I couldn't catch a cold, because that she's got a weak immune system that could kill her. I couldn't have conflict or confusion around her, because that could kill her. There were no drugs that we could use, because there weren't any. what we did was I went on the internet, found some non-FDA approved procedures that we could do, and we would go to meetings. At first, she'd be able to walk. Then, after a day or two, she couldn't walk, so I got a wheelchair and I carried her in a wheelchair. A couple of days later, that wasn't working, and she couldn't talk, so we used to get on the computer and type out. That didn't work after a while. Now, this is really rapid. This is like within a couple of days. We went to a blinking system. Yes, no. The love that we got from the fellowship, people would come over the house to have meetings for us. And then that's when I learned the value of the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. She got placed on hospice. And they said, you need to start making preparations. It's only by God's grace. And I'm still here, still sober. So, we had an appointment to go to the hospital to have some final tests done, and Debbie asked for a glass of water, which is really surprising because she hadn't been talking for a period of time. Got a glass of water. We went down to the hospital and had an MRI done. And the results came back, and the lesions on her brain had disappeared. See, the disease she had was like having multiple sclerosis and Alzheimer's simultaneously. It created lesions on the brain. The lesions on the brain had disappeared. I said, let's get married. We got married 2 weeks later, and she was dancing at her own wedding. And that's when I had my first spiritual experience. And I said, I'm all in. Because I saw God do what no human being could do. These were some of the best doctors around. And they said, you got no chance. She was up and dancing. And not only did I see it, people in the fellowship saw it. They saw it. They were at the wedding. So, a couple years go by. Now, see, Debbie not only had HIV, but she became a diabetic. She had pancreatitis. She had a hysterectomy. So every time I was spending so much time in doctor's offices and hospitals, half my time I was spending in the hospital, half my time I was spending working, quarter time in AA. And she had developed these pains on her side. So we had it checked out, and what she had was gallstones. So the doctor said, well, look, you can either have an operation, have them removed, or you can keep coming back to the hospital back and forth. I said, well, doc, with her previous existing conditions, how difficult is this operation going to be? He said, it's only going to be about 30% more difficult. So Debbie and I talked about it, and we said, well, look, I'll take that bet. Because we've lived through a situation where they said we had no chance. So I'll take that. So we give them the okay to do the operation. The first red flag was she's in the room, they bring her dinner, and they have a regular meal plan for her. She's a diabetic, so I had to get that straight. Then we have the operation. And she was supposed to leave the operating theater and go into intensive care. So I go into intensive care, and she's not there. I say, oh, she must be back in the operating theater. So I go down to the operating theater, She's not there. They must have taken her to her old room. So I go to her old room, and she's not there. So I'm walking around the hospital saying, where the hell is my wife? And I find her on a gurney in the hallway because somebody forgot to sign the admission papers to get her admitted to intensive care. And if it hadn't been what I had learned in this program, I would have blown up that hospital. So we finally get her back into intensive care, and I had been in the hospital for a couple days, and I decided to go home and get some rest. So as soon as I was living in Stone Mountain at that time, so I leave Grady to go to Stone Mountain. As soon as my head hit the pillow, I got the call. You need to come back down to the hospital. So I go back down to the hospital, and they tell me, they say, look, she's bleeding internally. We can't stop the bleeding. We're going to have to go back in. But before we do that, you're going to have to sign this piece of paper because this is a very high-risk operation. Now, I've heard people talk about how hard it is doing the steps. Try signing that. The steps are a piece of cake to sign in that. So, we had the operation. She gets out, and she's bleeding from all her orifices. Orifices, her eyes, her ears, her nose, her mouth, just continually bleeding, bleeding, bleeding. Her blood pressure's going down. I'm saying, what's up with this, doc? What's going on? What is going on? I say, well, you want to keep her on life support, you want to take her off. And I said, Doc, I don't have that much power to make that call. Why don't we do this? Why don't we monitor her for the next minute or hour or so, and then we'll make a decision after that. So during that time, some of her relatives had come up from Florida, and the luggage was in the ICU room. And, you know, if you've ever been in ICU, it's very limited space. So I said, what I'm going to do, I'll take the bags down to my car to give us just a little more space. And when I came back, Debbie had passed on. And as traumatic as that was, what that really was, that was God doing for me what I could not do for myself. Because any decision that I made in my own mind's eye would have been the wrong decision. If I kept her on life support, I would have beat myself up for the remainder of my life because I made her suffer. If I took her off life support, I would have beat myself up because I quit on her and we've already had one miracle. My higher power loves me so much that he took that decision away from me. And that's when I had my second spiritual experience. And this was in 2000. I had purchased this little franchise. You all have seen the commercial on TV. You've seen the commercial with George Foreman and Invent Help, the caveman. I own that franchise here in Atlanta because I had gotten it from me and Debbie. And when Debbie dies, I said my two favorite words. I don't care. I don't care. Lost all interest. Lost all interest. I lost my shirt, my pants, my jacket. I lost so much money. It was ridiculous. And I don't care. I don't care about money. I don't care. I can always get money. But I couldn't get that back. I couldn't get my wife back. So why am I doing this? So, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually, men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. They're all such unfortunates. They're not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances, less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. Some of these we bought. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember, we did with alcohol. Cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it's too much for us. But there is one that has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. Number one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrong. Six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continue to take personal inventory. When we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening, as the result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaim, "What an order, I can't go do with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he was sought. I want to thank you all for 12-stepping me tonight. Thank you so much.